here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back, Crossover NBA Podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What's happening, Mannix? I'm broadcasting live from the bunker. I got HEPA filters running at double time. I'm triple masked. I'm never leaving.
I think some of those things for you could be true. I am on the other side of that spectrum. I am in a hotel room in New Orleans. The last few days I was in San Antonio doing some boxing stuff, so I'm out and about here a little bit, and I can tell you, in Texas, not big mask country, not big concern country, I guess.
Shocking.
Yep. It's the way it is in different parts of this world. But look, that's going to be the focus of this podcast, the COVID issues that are ravaging the NBA and what options the NBA has to do about it. For kind of a detailed medical breakdown, I encourage people to listen to Howard's conversation with Dr. Robbie Sicca. Am I saying his last name right? Did
yes.
I get that right? Yeah, Sicca. They talked for the Friday version of this pod, and they kind of went through all the scenarios that are in play right now when it comes to COVID. And Howard, I'm going to ask you to kind of paraphrase some of that over the course of this podcast, because right now the NBA is in a bad place. More than 70 players, as we record this, are in the NBA's COVID protocols. Teams are getting decimated. I don't think that's too strong a word. They're getting decimated by positive tests to the point where the NBA has been changing its roster rules on the fly. Now, not only do teams have the option of signing players via the hardship exception, they are required to if they have a certain number of guys that are in the NBA's protocol. So I guess big picture, Howard, we'll start there. I mean, you know, it feels like we're right back where we started, you know, last season, where we were in January, when the first full month of last season, and, you know, teams were getting just, you know, crushed left and right by this virus. What do you see as far as where the NBA is at?
I mean, obviously in a really bad place, and one that I don't think anybody really anticipated, Chris. And this is the problem with, you know, these variants come along, Delta comes along, and it seemed like, you know, the NBA and society at large kind of withstood that well enough. And I don't know if what we're seeing right now is, because you and I are not scientists, and I don't think anybody's sharing this information. I don't know if this is just an Omicron wave because it is so contagious, and so we're getting a gazillion positive tests among NBA players, or if this is just in general, the system is just kind of cracked. I tend to think it's just more about, you know, more the greater, you know, spread of Omicron, because the NBA's protocols up until this point had held pretty well. And so that this wave is happening, and it's happening nationwide, worldwide, I think tends to indicate that this is not an NBA problem specifically. But it is an NBA problem now because, yes, rosters are decimated, as you point out. Somebody had tweeted earlier today, I think, that like only 10 of the 30 teams do not have somebody in protocols right now. We've gone from Twitter being a steady feed of guys being put in protocols to a steady feed of guys who are being signed off the scrap heap, play, you know, names that we hadn't heard in months and sometimes longer. And so, you know, look, among other issues, health stuff aside, and that's no small thing, but I'm going to put aside for a second. As a basketball matter and as a business matter, this is terrible because you're putting an inferior product out. We're seeing lineups and starting lineups that look like something out of the preseason or sometimes summer league. And that's not what people are spending hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars to see when they buy tickets. And of course, you and I are recording this just a few days before Christmas, and that Christmas Day slate is really important, and it might not include several major names. So the NBA is in a really bad spot right here. They've postponed, what, 7 games so far? And it seems like that's not going to be the end.
No, it's not going to be the end. They had more than 30 postponed games last year, and it's trending in that direction right now. To kind of get to brass tacks here, Howard, the NBA is not going to pause its season. It would take something even more catastrophic than this, significantly more catastrophic than this, for the NBA to pause the season. The message I've been getting is that the league is going to do everything humanly possible to power through this latest surge and try to get into, or get, you know, deeper past the holidays when they hope things will start to settle down a little bit. Now, last year's not a great example because vaccines came along en masse late in the season, but we did see, you know, after January, February, things start to tick downward a little bit for in terms of positive tests and guys being placed in the COVID protocols. So the NBA is going to push through this. Now, the big question that the NBA is going to have to answer and deal with is, how do they handle testing? Specifically, do they test liberally like they are at the moment, where everybody is getting tested basically every day? Or do they test only when a player says he is symptomatic? That's something I'm hearing a lot from coaches, from player agents, from players themselves, the handful that I've spoken to. I spoke to one player who entered into the COVID protocols this week, or last couple of days, I should say, who said he didn't, I mean, he was on his way to the gym to work out when he was told he had tested positive for COVID. So his point was, I feel fine. There's nothing wrong with me. I didn't know I had it. And I think the players would prefer that approach. That's the same approach that, as we speak, the NFL is currently taking. The NFL effectively saying, we're going to test only symptomatic players or players that want to be tested on a regular basis for whatever reasons. So the question, I think, is going to become, whether it's today, tomorrow, this week, next month, how does the NBA approach that aspect of this? I have some thoughts on it too, but I want to let you kind of weigh in there, Howard. Like, where do you think the NBA is going to come down on the issue of testing?
Well, let me hit the pause question real quick first, because I agree. I don't think there's any chance of a pause. And part of that is just a practical matter here. Last year, there was no pause when things were at their absolute worst in this pandemic, and we're in a much better place now than we were, say, in January. And the NBA was postponing games like crazy then, but they never paused the season even then, in the darkest days of the pandemic and during the times when their teams were being racked by positive tests and the Wizards lost 2 weeks of their season. They didn't pause then. They're not going to pause now. And it would have been easier to pause then because they did the season in 2 36-game blocks and arenas were not all booked up. We're back to kind of normal now, where arenas are booked up. There are not available dates. They scheduled a full 82-game season and 1 through 82, not into a first half and a second half block. So they just don't have the kind of flexibility to put the whole thing on hold and then reschedule stuff later. You know, even if you said, well, they'll just go further into summer again. Well, okay, but those arenas might not be available. So it's not that easy. Also, if you see the way things are going now, where G League teams are being called up to supplement NBA rosters, where, you know, guys like Isaiah Thomas and Damian Dotson and other guys who've been out of the league are being signed to rosters, that tells you everything you need to know. The NBA would rather go on with guys pulled up off the scrap heap and semi-retirement and overseas or wherever they're playing, the G League, and keep going that way. They would clearly rather do that and keep the games going, which has some merit, Chris, but again, it's cheapening the product. These are not, you know, these are wins and losses that are going in the standings by substitute rosters, by second and third teams. It's not the equivalent of a normal season where, okay, you got some injuries. Yeah, that happens, but not half your roster gone at the same time. So it is warping things a bit. The NBA seems to be fine with that. As to whether or not they'll just stop testing guys who are asymptomatic and just assume everyone's healthy unless they've got symptoms, I don't know. I'm gonna punt on this one. I rarely just say like I'm throw up my hands. I don't know, but this one's complicated because if you go that route, Chris, are you possibly endangering other members of your organization? I mean, presumably everyone's vaccinated, and that's why a lot of these, you know, we're getting a lot of these asymptomatic cases because guys are testing positive, but not having symptoms because they're vaccinated or they have very, very mild symptoms. But to what extent can you still spread this? And science is still learning about the virus and about this variant and about the Omicron variant. We don't know what danger you're putting other people in. And so it's not just about, oh, the players are young and healthy, they're fine. Yeah, okay, great, probably. But it's who else you might infect. And there are older people in this league, people who work for teams, people on coaching staffs, referees, you know, team officials of all kinds. So you still have some responsibility, but I honestly don't know what the right answer there is for the NBA, because it is destroying their rosters and destroying this section of the schedule. But I don't know that it's the right thing morally or scientifically to just say we're going to stop testing guys unless they've got symptoms.
Well, I don't believe the NBA is going to take that tact, because the message that you get when you speak to league officials is that we're going to follow the science. And the science to this point has emphasized strongly the need for testing. That has been, especially, you know, as I watch kind of the political shows over the weekend, listen to some of the experts that have been speaking, they make the point that testing right now is every bit as valuable as being vaccinated. As people are starting to gather for Christmas and New Year's, I will not be gathering for any either of those things. I plan to, you know, go hole up in Vermont or something for like a week and a half until it's all over.
I'll rent you out my bunker.
Yes. No, I've got my own in Vermont. I'm good. But as things start to pick up in terms of large crowds, you need to test as often as possible. So if that's what the science is saying, Adam Silver is not going to buck the science. He's not going to do it. I mean, it's one thing for the NFL to do it. The NFL also, if you're looking for excuses for why they're doing this, they play outdoors. So that's a little bit easier when you're talking about playing games in an outdoor environment. But the NBA, they're just not going to do that. And so I'm with you. I don't really know what the solution is. Do you kind of cross your fingers and hope that in the next couple of months things get better? But I don't know. I think the NBA is going to have a lot to think about, you know, the next few weeks.
They do. But let me shift the discussion just slightly, Chris, because we're talking solely about players and, of course, coaches. We've had a bunch of coaches put in protocols as well. But we're not talking enough about the NBA's policy beyond that. Like, what has the NBA done to lead on COVID when it comes to community spread? Like, there's no uniform policy by the league across its arenas for fans. So some arenas, everyone's wearing masks. Some arenas, no one's wearing masks. And a lot of places, of course, people are still badly wearing masks or barely wearing them. And by the way, a lot of people who are courtside, sitting courtside in close proximity to players while not wearing masks or wearing masks on their chins. Why is there no league-wide policy on dealing with your own fans? Why
the mask on the chin thing is like my favorite. Like, it's just... What exactly is the
folks, we've had almost 2 years to like figure this out, right? If it's just over your mouth, but not your nose, it might as well not be on at all. If it's over your chin, you just look like a dork. And it, you know, I mean, it's amazing to me. We are almost at the end of 2021. People still don't get it.
Well, you see, one of the solutions I've seen from, I think it's in Toronto where they're going to begin this, is they're not going to open the concession stands. You know, because if you have concession stands open, people can reasonably say, look, I'm eating, I'm drinking, I'm doing all those things.
Well, that's the problem. There's
But at the same time, the NBA teams are going to take a massive hit financially if those concession stands aren't
open. But look, NBA, you're either going to be responsible or you're not going to be responsible. And how you deal with your own players and coaches and staffs is only one piece of this. You are a public entertainment entity in which you would bring thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people to your buildings indoors. And, you know, why aren't there mask mandates in all NBA arenas? Why aren't there vaccine mandates for all NBA games?
Well, that's the one
testing or produce a negative test. Why aren't you offering the vaccine for free at NBA arenas and offering testing at NBA? Like, build this all in. If you're going to be the responsible, high-minded entity that we sometimes project you to be, live up to it. What have they done this season that has shown any leadership on this? They're still riding on the coattails of Rudy Gobert shutting down the league and saying, look, symbolically, we were the ones who got everybody aware of this virus and caused the cascade of everything else shutting down in March 2020. Great. What have you done now? What are you doing now?
Yeah, it's a problem. I'm actually, you know, not to inject too much of my own opinion on this. I'm in favor of kind of, you know, vaccine mandates for buildings. And after that, you don't have to wear a mask. Like, I mean, it's because I just, most people are not wearing masks in these buildings anyway. If they're doing it, haphazardly. I'm just, you know, if you're double or I guess triple vaccinated at this point, because that the standard should be changed to being fully vaccinated, to being triple vax, take a triple shot. If you are, you know, all right, whatever. In a way, they told us, you know, I heard Draymond Green say something about this recently, and he's right. You know, he said he's doing everything he's being told. You know, he's been vaccinated, he's been boosted, and in that scenario, he's going to basically live his life. And I'm kind of for that. You know, if you're, you know, we've seen enough science where if you're basically double vaccinated and boosted, you can obviously still catch COVID, but the impacts are far less severe. It doesn't eliminate the chances of you infecting somebody outside of the arena, which is, I know, is problematic. But if you're going to find one middle, if it's even a middle ground, just have vaccination mandates in these buildings. I saw Boston's going to it now, which is not surprising after New York is already there. I'm sure there are a handful of other arenas out there. Is LA, I believe, is that? I don't know. Like what? I think just have vaccine mandates across the board and make that be, you know, at least your first line of defense.
Which is fine, but if I'm recalling correctly, didn't Masai Ujiri end up catching it?
He
was fully vaccinated and at a gathering where everybody else was also fully vaccinated and it still spread. And it still comes down to if, you know, you might be fine and you might say, well, let everybody in if they're vaccinated, you don't need masks. Okay, but it's still spreading anyway. And while you probably won't get very, very sick if you were vaccinated, you still might spread it to somebody who is unvaccinated or who is more vulnerable. Right. So there's still that issue. And so, you know, there's varying levels that they could go to here. But what the NBA has done so far, it feels like, is basically nothing when it comes to anybody beyond their own teams. They're not dealing with the fan element of this. Toronto has reduced capacity, but that was more of a local jurisdiction thing, not the Raptors themselves doing it. You know, where
are
these other measures?
Teams are not going to do it. They're not going to reduce capacity.
But that's the thing. I don't see the NBA making any attempt, nor have they done any messaging at all, by the way. Like, when's the last time we heard from any NBA officials talking about how they plan to deal with this more broadly? We've heard.
No, it's just, I spoke to Mike Bass over there last week before I was writing something. He said they're going to follow the science on this. And I guess we'll see where the science leads as the holidays kind of pick up. All right. I want to stay along this track and talk about the return of Kyrie Irving, who is expected to be back in the Nets rotation at some point. In the next couple of weeks, he was announced that he was going to return and he was immediately placed in the COVID protocol. So, some irony there. You know, Kyrie, it seemed like he had no shot, you know, about a month ago of getting back into the Nets mix without being vaccinated. Joe Tsai he's the owner of the Nets. He had been pretty adamant that he wants the players to be vaccinated. He's very pro-vaccine. It seemed like Sean Marks and Joe Tsai were in lockstep on this, but the Nets have been among the teams that have been completely destroyed, have their roster ravaged by COVID-19. So now Kyrie Irving is going to be back eventually, going to be practicing with the team, and playing in the road games he's eligible to play in. So if you get your reaction, Howard, Kyrie coming back.
So I apologize in advance, or apologize midstream, I guess, for continuing a fairly cynical view of everything the NBA is doing right now. But Kyrie Irving not playing for the Nets up until now was never about high-minded policy or health concerns, because if New York didn't have a law on the books that banned him from playing home games, he'd be playing. He would have been playing. The only reason the Nets decided not to play him is because they didn't want to have him playing only road games. So that they're bringing him back now is completely consistent with why they stopped, why they didn't play him in the first place, or why they told him to stay away. On both ends, it was a pragmatic basketball decision. At the beginning, it was, well, you're too good of a player, too important to have only for road games, and then come home and we have a different starting lineup and a different rotation, and it's disruptive and it's inconsistent, and it doesn't help team cohesion, right? So that was a basketball decision more than it was about a, you know, public health decision. Now they're bringing him back for the same basketball reasons, which is, oh, well, our roster is destroyed and we're running Kevin Durant into the ground. We need you back, even if it's only for road games. So they're making a concession, but the concession is not so much about health and about whether or not he's a bigger risk as an unvaccinated person. It's more about they just needed players. They needed healthy bodies, and especially when as talented as Kyrie Irving is. So, you know, look, was there some element of Joe Tsai wanting everybody vaccinated and he's fine, right? Joe Tsai has his views on this, and I agree with them. But I don't think that their original decision on Kyrie Irving had anything to do with following the science or following public health recommendations. It was about not wanting the disruption of him only being eligible for half of the games. And now they brought him back because they're desperate.
Yeah. And my question is going to be, how long is he back? And, you know, in the coming months, you know, as this wave kind of passes us by and the Nets get 10, 12, 13 bodies healthy, are they willing to continue to be utilizing Kyrie Irving as a part-time player? I think you and I both agree, Howard, and you live in New York now, and I'm there a lot. That New York mandate is not going to change when Eric Adams takes over as mayor. I don't see it. What may change is the completely insane loophole in that mandate that has unvaccinated visiting players being eligible to play. I mean, if Kyrie Irving can't play, I don't know why Bradley Beal or any of the other unvaccinated players that are out there are eligible to play. But I just don't see the city changing that mandate. So moving forward, Kyrie is going to be a part-time player in Brooklyn, which is great in the month of January when you need an all-NBA guard out there playing for you. Not so much when you get to May and you get to the playoffs and you're in a game seven and maybe you're on the road and your star player can't suit up for you. I guess that's the question. Like, you know, as everybody gets healthy, are they better off having Kyrie play in half the games? Or, you know, do they, once they get healthy, do they send him home again?
As a basketball matter, they clearly believed when the season started that they were better off with zero Kyrie than with, you know, 39 games or whatever they were going to get.
But what if he goes out, Howard, and averages like 28-9 in the month of January?
And he probably will. He very well.
I don't know. I mean, I have not seen, of all the stuff he's posted on social media, I have not seen much of him working out of the gym. Like, I don't know how long it's going to take him to get into game shape.
You know, he could come back and get hurt immediately too by rushing back. So. It would be very awkward if he comes in, stabilizes them for a month, they get healthy, everybody gets out of protocols, and they say, all right, thanks, go back to being banished to your home while we continue on without you. But if they're going to be consistent, that would be the way to do it. I just think it'd be very hard to, that's, you know, putting genie back in the bottle type stuff. However, my bigger question, Chris, is this one. What happens when the playoffs roll around? If he's still not vaccinated and the law hasn't changed, really? You're going to go into the playoffs with Kyrie Irving playing only road playoff games? And you might have...
That doesn't work.
A game that seven doesn't. At home and you're without one of your biggest stars because... I mean, you know,
here's the thing. If you're the Nets, do you expertly tank so you wind up in the fifth seed so you never have to play a game seven as you move forward?
But half of your games, are still going to be, if it's six games or fewer, half are
you
still
want to
gonna...
avoid. But you want, they might be the first team in league history to want to avoid home court advantage. With
possibly
Kyrie in the mix.
It's a very strange place to be. But that's the thing. Like, I don't care what they do for the next couple of months. You know, do it as safely as you can. Kyrie's playing, Kyrie's not playing, whatever. I don't care. But this is a much bigger issue in the playoffs. You cannot have a guy of his caliber be a part-time player and ineligible for home games in the playoffs when you're trying to win a championship. And that's where they will still be, assuming he does not get vaccinated and assuming New York's law doesn't change.
Well, you know, the conversations I've had with people in Brooklyn, what they are hoping for, and they have no reason to be optimistic about this, but they're hoping Kyrie's back. He's in the facility. He's around Durant. He's around Harden. He's around his teammates. And he comes around in the next month or so to getting vaccinated. I believe, as current rules state, like if you just get the one Johnson & Johnson shot, you are considered fully vaccinated by NBA standards. I don't know if that's the same with New York or though how there that mandate works. But whatever it is, like I know the Nets are hoping that the players get to Kyrie. They don't believe there any pressure applied by them being the coaching staff, the front office, ownership is going to work. Players might. And I think the hope is that, you know, Kyrie being around these guys, getting back into the, you know, competitive rhythm, playing well, winning games, that, you know, has an impact on him. I don't know if it will. He's a very, very difficult guy to kind of predict what he's going to do next, but that's sort of the idea.
We don't need to go down this tangent too far, but
yeah,
if he comes back in the next couple of weeks and is playing well, I'm using that to try to trade him. I'm doing everything possible to see if somebody out there wants him, because I don't want to go into the playoffs with a part-time star point guard who can only play road games, and then he can opt out this summer. I don't know that I want to tie myself to him long-term again, given the volatility and the inconsistency and the unreliability. So they've got an opportunity here between now and February 10th. Play him, get his trade value up, and see what you can get.
Yeah, I'm with you there. All right, I want to get to a couple of basketball topics before we end the show. You look at the Eastern Conference standings right now, Howard. You got Brooklyn up there at the top, no surprise. Chicago up there at the top, kind of a surprise. But, you know, the Bulls spent a lot of money this offseason. They expected to be in that playoff mix. At number three in the Eastern Conference are my Cleveland Cavaliers, sitting there with a 19-12 record. They have the second best defense in the NBA. They have one of the best point differentials in the NBA. They've got 13 wins this season, Howard, by 10 points or more. I mean, of all the things that have surprised about this wacky season so far, it's been plagued by a lot of different problems. The Cleveland Cavaliers being, you know, in a top four position in the Eastern Conference right around Christmas is right up there in this mix. Explain to me how we got here with the Cavaliers sitting there at 19-12 with, by the way, one of their best players, Colin Sexton, done for the season with that meniscus tear.
Or is that part of why they're so good?
Ah, you took my line of thinking there, but go ahead. You make your argument first.
Well, I mean, listen, it's all. I'm not going to put this all on Colin Sexton. That's just mean. But it's not a unique thought to say that the Garland Sexton backcourt was problematic over the last couple of years. Yeah, obviously, both young, both smaller guards. Kind of the Dame Lillard, CJ McCollum quandary, where it's like, you know, they're both really talented, both can do a lot offensively, but leaves you, vulnerable defensively because of size and general interest in defense. And so it simplifies things when you're down to like, no, our chief ball handler / scorer is Garland. We know that now. Like, I think having that focus and that clarity helps. I think Garland taking another step helps. I think obviously Evan Mobley and his defense and his versatility helps. The weirdly effective big front court of Markin and Mobley, Jared Allen helps. Starting the season with some of these guys, where last year they were obviously, you know, turning over midseason when they got Jared Allen in the first place. All of that helps. Okoro taking another step forward helps. Like, it's everything. Ricky Rubio's playmaking and kind of selflessness as an offensive orchestrator. Like, it's kind of everything at once, and that's why you can't see it coming. It's not, oh, we got this one franchise-changing player, though Mobley may be that. Like, if it were just Mobley's arrival alone, they would not be this good. He's a big piece of that, obviously. But it's all of these things, I think, at once. They're a plus 15.2 net rating. That's insane for a team that has been in the lottery for, whatever, four straight years. Their defense is legit. They've got size and length. I still don't think we should expect this team to be top four, top five in the East by the time the playoffs arrive, but it's another weird season, Chris. Like, the way things are going, all the volatility with rosters, COVID stuff that we still can't foresee, who knows? But they're legitimately good.
Yeah, they are legitimately good. Darius Garland, to me, is an all-star right now. He has been phenomenal for this team. I'm looking at his numbers here, and what is he averaging as we record this now? He's at about 20 points per game. He's handing out about 7.5 assists. He's shooting close to 40% from three, 48% from the floor. He has been great all season long. And I think they've found something with this backcourt of Garland and Okoro. Okoro was a starter last year as well, but Garland, Okoro next to each other just seems to work. And it certainly works a lot better than Garland Sexton. I don't know how sustainable Lauri Markkanen at the three is. Like, that to me still feels like a house of cards. But you know, right now the supersized backcourt has worked. And what is sustainable is Mobley and Jared Allen works. That has a lot to do with Mobley's ability to be a defender on the perimeter. He's very good out there contesting shots. And Allen, tremendous shot blocker on the inside. So that duo there has some staying power. You mentioned Rubio. How many teams in the league would like Ricky Rubio right now? Like, you know, just an unselfish playmaker who'll start, come off the bench, whatever you need from him, is well-liked by his teammates. I mean, there's probably a dozen teams that wish they had the foresight to go out and acquire Ricky Rubio last summer. Kevin Love is giving them something. He's not the Kevin Love of old, but he's giving them a little bit something off the bench. To me, I think this Cavs team is a playoff team this year. I don't think that's a big leap to take. I'm curious, Howard, what do they do with Sexton right now? Because, you know, Sexton was on this podcast, you know, last year, and, you know, he wants to get paid. Like, he wants to be paid like an all-star caliber player. He just doesn't fit that way in Cleveland. So if I'm the Cavs, I sort of take the temperature of the market out there and see if there's a team that likes Colin Sexton enough, not to get him back this year because that's probably not going to happen, but to have his bird rights for next year, to be able to re-sign him for a big dollar number and have him over the long term. And even if you're going to get like 50 cents on the dollar for it, find pieces that work alongside Garland, alongside Okoro, alongside Evan Mobley. You've got your core right now. You've got those guys are three first-round picks that you've had over the last few years. All the bad basketball that you had to swallow to get those first-round picks, you've got players now for it. Now it's about building around those guys. So I'd like to see, you know, the Cavs not dump Colin Sexton, but if they can find shooters or, you know, backups at key positions, backup, you know, help in the backcourt, I'd be more inclined to do that because I don't see Colin Sexton accepting like a sixth man role with this team next year, which as we look at the way they're playing right now, that's probably optimal for him, backing up Garland, backing up Okoro, and being kind of that instant offense off the bench.
Yeah, and you and I both know young guys with a lot of talent, guys who are lottery picks, don't usually warm very quickly to the idea of being sixth men at that early stage of their career. He's going to want to go and be a starter somewhere. And he'll be a restricted free agent this summer. There will be offers out there. I think that he's part of their present day quandary, right? Like, you did not expect a leap this dramatic this soon. And so now as they head toward the trade deadline, and we talked a little bit about buyers and sellers last week, but you know, should you be dangling Sexton? Cause some team that, you know, he can't play this season, but some team inheriting him or acquiring him now would then inherit his restricted free agent, you know, the ability to match any offer. So there could be some incentive to try to get him now. On top of that, you mentioned Rubio. He's an expiring contract at nearly $18 million. Kevin Love's only got 1 year left after this one. Granted, it's a big number, 29, but still, like, those are guys who could help somebody else and maybe helps unclog your cap a little bit, maybe helps you fortify the core that you're building. On the other hand, this group's really good right now, and you just want to play it out and see where it goes. But I'll be curious to see what they do, because I do think Love, Rubio, and even Sexton, those are all pieces that you could possibly dangle out there if you want to use this opportunity. You know, you're playing with found money right now, and they could do a little bit more to shape themselves for the future.
Fun story. J.B. Bickerstaff, you know, who's had so many interim titles over his career as a coach, he's done a great job with that team. Probably, certainly one of the front runners, if not the front runner for Coach of the Year right now. So, kudos to Cleveland for, you know, getting it together. They won 60 games in the 3 years after LeBron left. They're at 19 right now. Just a remarkable turnaround for this team this year. Finally, Howard, I want to finish in Boston. The Celtics have won 2 out of 3 since Jaylen Brown has come back to the mix, which has quieted some of the chatter, let's call it, that it was time to break up the Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum duo. You know, in the last week that Jaylen Brown has been back, Jason Tatum just won conference player of the week. So, like, it works out. It's working out with them. My sense, to kind of, you know, kind of give my lay of the land here, and I'm pretty close to the people in Boston, that there's never really been much consideration given to trading Jaylen Brown. What they're concerned with within the Celtics is, do they have the right pieces around these guys? Like, is the combination of Smart and Josh Richardson and Romeo Langford and, you know, some of the young guys they have there, do they work opposite Jaylen and Jason? Rob Williams, is he the right guy opposite Jaylen and Jason? There's never really been, from what I've been able to gather, any type of decommitment from Jaylen Brown. It's been frustrating. He's been in and out of the lineup, and you know, he's only got, what, I think, a couple of years left on his contract, so you got to start thinking about that as well. But, you know, the idea that they're going to move Jaylen Brown, I think it would take something huge, like Damian Lillard level huge, to move Jaylen Brown, which I think is the right thing to do. Jaylen Brown is an all-star. He's an excellent two-way player. The two of them, Jaylen and Jason, have played well off each other, well enough of each other to believe in them long-term. That's kind of how I see it. How do you see things in Boston right now?
I think the discussions about breaking them up are premature. I mean, if somebody blows you away with an offer, that's a different thing, right? But I wouldn't be proactively trying to break them up. This is their fifth full season together. And when I say full season, like, that should have a big fat asterisk on it, because every season
three
for the last...
Three of them have been weird.
Yeah, they were in some very strange times. But a quick review. In their time together, this is, you know, as we tape today, they're 203-135. That's a 600 winning percentage. So 600 winning percentage in their time together, Tatum and Brown. A lot has changed around them during that time, and a lot of guys have come and gone. So quick review here, because the real frustration for Celtics fans, I'm sure, aside from the record, is just playoff failures, right? 2018, that's Tatum's rookie year. They lose in the Eastern Conference Finals to Cleveland in Game 7. They lost to LeBron. And Tatum's a rookie that year. We're really going to hold that over them? The next year, they lose in the second round to the Bucks. Now they're losing to Giannis. The next year, they're in the conference finals again. So two conference finals appearances in their first three full years together, Tatum and Brown. They lose to the Heat, who, of course, you know, go to the finals. And then they lose to the Nets last year in the first round. And that looks like backwards. It looks like regression because it's the first round. Well, all right, but you lost to Kevin Durant, who was playing like the best player on earth, and James Harden. Along the way, you go from Kyrie as your leading scorer those first two postseasons, to Kemba, to now no Kemba, no Kyrie, no Gordon Hayward, no Terry Rozier. We've talked about this before, but like, you don't, they've lost talent around them. The problem is not so much Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum as it is everything else. They've bled talent for 3-4 years running here and have not replace them sufficiently. And there's no elite playmaker on this roster. Now, if you want to say that Brown and Tatum have to do that themselves, fine. But it's not Marcus Smart and it's not Dennis Schroeder. But they don't have an elite playmaker. And you look at the great teams around the league, they've got a James Harden or a Durant or both. They've got a LeBron. They've got, or a Kyle Lowry for that matter. There are guys who you can rely on as playmakers, as offensive orchestrators on most of the contenders. Where is that guy for Boston?
It's not there. And that's why I've believed that the Celtics should do everything they can to extract CJ McCollum from Portland. I'm a believer that another offensive-oriented lead guard is what the Celtics need. McCollum, thankfully, it sounds like he's going to be back sooner than later from this collapsed lung issue he's been dealing with. So, yeah, that's the next step there. I agree with you. The extraction of talent from this team has been a bigger problem than anything we're seeing from Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum on the court. All right, Howard, good stuff. Hopefully next week after the holiday, we'll be discussing more positive things. I'm not all that optimistic because this wave is not diminishing anytime soon. We can hope, right? We can cross our fingers and say.
We can. It can only get better, right? Didn't my guy Howard Jones say that? Things can only get better? Am I allowed to quote 80s lyrics here?
If you need me, I'll be in Vermont.